everybody. We'd love to get your feedback. You can post a review wherever you found this podcast. Find us on Twitter at RealDMC or send us a message at feedback@realdmc.com. If you send us some feedback, we may include it in our listener feedback section and you'll hear it on the show. Thank you for listening, and now on to the episode.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Real DMC podcast. DMC stands for Dave, Marcus, and Colin. We can start with a quick follow-up to our Tropic Thunder pod. We were discussing the fact that Kirk Lazarus in that film has 5 Acting Academy Awards. Colin pointed out that Katharine Hepburn only has 4, so no one has ever actually received 5 awards, which is what made Kirk Lazarus such an amazing actor in that film. But then we were talking about, there are other people that must have a lot more Academy Awards. And I jokingly said that John Williams had probably 11, Marcus said 34. Turns out he only has 5, so I was quite surprised by that. Out of 52 nominations, he's only won 5 times for the Academy Awards. I was actually very surprised by that, so I just wanted to update our listeners because we were a little incorrect on the Tropic Thunder pod.
Better than Glenn Close.
That's true, actually. Yeah. How many times has she been nominated for the Acting Award?
I don't know, 6 or 7 times.
Many. John Williams has done better at the Grammys, though, because he has 25 of those out of 72 nominations. So the guy's done okay, at least in the nomination department.
72 nominations. Man, it's like every year. Many a year.
Who beat John Williams out of the composing category the equivalent of 47 times? I still find that surprising.
I find that very surprising.
Listener feedback.
We did receive a question from a Mr. Lead Farmer, so somebody who also listened to our Tropic Thunder pod. Mr. Lead Farmer says, you guys seem to pick movies that are all over the place. That's true.
Have we had this feedback before?
Do you take requests? We will take requests, actually. So if you want to send us a message of a movie you'd like us to do, feel free to do so. And then he says, and secondly, what's one movie that you'd never want to watch or review?
A Serbian film.
Marcus. That's mine, Colin, actually.
I had to get it in.
I don't know if I'd actually want to do Zodiac, just because it would be like a 6-hour podcast. It's a fantastic film. I'm not sure if I'd have the stamina to record it.
Yeah, I went right where Colin was. I do not want to see the movie A Serbian Film, which is definitely not a recommendation from the Real DMC podcast. You can look up information about that film online. We'll just leave it at that.
I'm sort of with Marcus. There's a film I don't want to do. I just don't think I could do it justice, and that's
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, that, yes, and Pulp Fiction. I don't think I have it in me to just go and do it, even though great films. I don't really know about what I'd never want to watch. I'm sure there's a lot that I'd never want to watch.
Lawrence of Arabia is another one that's just too big and classic.
Oh, I could totally talk about Lawrence of Arabia. I love that movie.
It's a great movie, but it took a while. We went 2 hours on The Crow, which is only like a 100-minute movie or something.
that's because 40 minutes of me was reminiscing about how The Crow impacted my life. That's okay, though. That's fun.
Today's film.
Today we're here to talk about director Richard Kelly's first film from the year 2001. Let's talk about the cult classic, Donnie Darko.
So, why'd you move here?
My mom had to get a restraining order against my stepdad. He has emotional problems.
Oh, I have those too. What kind of emotional problems does your dad have?
I met a new friend.
Real or imaginary?
Wake up, Donnie.
Imaginary.
I'm gonna tell you a little story today about a young man whose life was completely destroyed by these instruments of fear.
I haven't seen stuff.
Donnie is experiencing what is commonly called a daylight hallucination.
I have to obey him. He saved my life.
Have you ever seen a portal?
Has he ever told you about his friend Frank, the giant bunny rabbit?
The what?
Every living thing follows along set path, and if you could see your path or channel, then you could see into the future, right?
I'm not going to be able to continue this conversation.
Don't worry. You got away with it.
What is going to happen?
I only have a few days left before they catch me.
We assume that for most people have watched the movies that we're talking about, but if for some reason you have not seen Donnie Darko, we are going to spoil the shit out of it, and it's one of those movies that is probably best experienced the first time going in cold and not really understanding it, because you really won't understand it when you watch it probably the first time. So anyways, just making that recommendation up front, because we are going to go into all the mythology and break down this movie with a fair amount of detail.
Or watch it once and then watch it again 20 years later and then you'll forget all about it.
Yeah, that's basically what I did.
Yep.
So, Dave, why did you pick this movie?
I stumbled on the opening of Donnie Darko and I watched about 5 minutes of it and I went, oh, wait, Maggie Gyllenhaal's in this movie? And then a couple of minutes later, oh, wait, Patrick Swayze's in this movie? And it made me realize that I had no recollection of the film whatsoever. And this was on my list of movies that I wanted to rewatch just because this movie has a pretty huge cult following. In fact, if you just do a search online, there are entire websites that are dedicated to dissecting this film. And I think that's pretty interesting. The other thing is that this is a movie that has a reputation as being a really good movie. And I recall when I watched it originally, I was underwhelmed. I kind of went away saying, well, I don't really know what the hype was about. Honestly, having watched it this time around, I had no recollection of the previous viewing. Like it was almost like I was watching it for the very first time. And I was thinking about it, you know, why is that? And I realized, well, this came out in 2001. At that time, I was in the process of remodeling a house. I had moved in with my mother-in-law and my wife was pregnant with our first child. So there was a lot going on in my life. That's another reason why potentially it didn't make an impact.
Yeah, you know, I had a very similar experience to you. Just, I could remember sort of frames of scenes, but really, it was like a whole, watching it for the first time. It was really quite an interesting experience.
Yeah. Same here. Guy did not remember Drew Barrymore in it.
Oh, I didn't remember Drew Barrymore in it at all.
Yeah, Noah Weil. I'm like, wait, that's, I'm like, holy shit. There's so many people in the movie too. It was surprising. And yeah, I don't remember. All I remember was like his big scary rabbit. And that was about it.
It's funny. I think the only thing I remembered from Donnie Darko was the theater scene. Yeah. As an image in my head, that was the only thing that I remembered. And that was it.
Which is funny. So we were watching Looper and you had the question about time travel. And Donnie Darko is listed as one of the top time travel movies on numerous people's lists. I'm like, the movie was about time travel? I do not remember that at all. I thought it was like a horror movie and the rabbit tormented him. It's so funny. I did not remember any of that.
I know, right? I sort of remembered that there was a time travel twist at the end. I started wondering, did I watch the original or did I watch the director's cut? And I watched the original. I watched it in April 2002, at least according to my Netflix history. And I gave it 4 stars out of 5. I did like it. I'm kind of surprised I never went back and watched it again, given that it has such a big cult following.
This was right around the time when a lot of internet movie journalism was exploding, right? So you had Ain't It Cool News, you had Coming Attractions. So some of these movie sites that had information about this. And there was a lot of online excitement for this movie. But when I saw it, I was just kind of underwhelmed. I was like, eh, okay, whatever, maybe not for me. And I pretty much forgot about it. I think I had a much better time watching the movie this time, though. At least I was pretty interested as I was watching it. The film maintains an 8.0 rating on the IMDb, which I do find pretty surprising, honestly. The Internet Movie Database is also a little bit of a, I don't know what you'd call it, a meter of public response and enthusiasm for movies. So I do think that a lot of super fans have probably voted this movie up over time. 8.0 is a pretty high score. So what do you guys think about that? Is it an 8.0 film?
I don't think so.
No.
I understand the rating because it has that cult following. It came out at the right time. The internet was new. It's hitting that target audience with IMDb and rating it. It's definitely inflated.
Let me ask you this. All three of you, looking at myself, all three of you.
Are you asking the large 6-foot rabbit standing next to you, by the way, as a third person?
Yes. Hello, Frank. What would each of us give this movie if on an IMDb score?
This is like maybe a 6.7, 6.8, maybe a 7.
I'm almost in the exact same range as Dave. For a first-time filmmaker, it's really impressive. What he put together and the world he built, I'd probably like 6.8, 6.9, somewhere right in there.
I'd put it in the 7 range. I'd probably get about a 7.2. I really liked it, I have to say.
There's some issues.
It does have a Metacritic score of 71% for the original theatrical release. And then, as Colin mentioned, there was a special edition. By the way, apparently Richard Kelly was not on board with the idea that the special edition was a, quote, director's cut. Apparently that was a move made by the distributor, really to try to drive sales, I assume. He thinks the film, as in its theatrical version, is fine as it is. He just wanted to take the opportunity to re-edit it and make this special edition. So we all watched the theatrical release. The special edition, I think, is another, what is it? Is another 25 minutes of content?
Yeah, it's about 20 minutes.
The special edition gives you a lot more information to understand the concept of time travel. I think a lot of people who have rated this movie up have spent time doing additional research and getting additional information via, you know, websites or talking to other people online. When you look at the theatrical version, it's very difficult to understand what's going on compared to, I think, what the broader message is or the broader theme was for the movie.
I think it's a bit ironic that they came out with a director's cut where he basically explains what is happening, having these elements from, you know, the philosophy of time travel book that is in the movie. I think it does a disservice to all the fans who love the theatrical release. People love the ambiguity of the first edition of this movie. It loses the mystery, and the explanation part of it becomes too direct, and it really just loses its charm. And we will talk about this. Dave, you're going to go through this. I like the questions, not the answers.
It's kind of interesting to leave these questions open-ended. How would they not know there's an airplane engine missing somewhere, right? I think that's a huge question, part of the mystery of what is going on. I think it depends on the type of person, right? Some people want it completely explained. They want the movie to be buttoned up and solid. And I think some people, they're okay with the ambiguity of it all.
I read somewhere, this is like the world's first flop that got a director's cut, which I thought was really, really interesting. When the director's cut came out, they had a big special screening for it, and it was like sold out, and it did really well, and it got a lot of really positive reviews. But then over time, people started having this negative reaction to it. It sort of ruined the theatrical version.
I looked at the runtime as I was going along, and it was an hour and 20 minutes, hour and 30 minutes into it. Nothing had been resolved, and I was still very engaged with the movie. I'm trying to figure out, like, where the fuck is this going? What exactly is happening?
Yeah.
So the ambiguity is actually one of the things that really drew me into the movie. That being said, when I go through the mythology of this time travel, I would dare say that none of the elements that I'm going to talk about are in any way represented in the movie itself in any way that you could actually understand them. So that's what I think is so fascinating. It's a pretty big leap to try to get some of the concepts that are presented in other external media, you know, like this, the time travel book that you're talking about, which is what Richard Kelly did, right? They put some of that content online so people could read it. But the idea of actually having to have a companion piece to a movie outside the movie just to understand the movie,
yeah,
it's interesting. Much. And then it's also interesting the fact that not having that information in the movie might still make it a better movie, right? So the fun is like you need the outside stuff to understand it, but you don't really want it in the movie because it lessens the mystery and makes it less engaging.
Dave, maybe you should go back and listen to our Prometheus podcast, where you were very upset that I was talking about all this stuff that wasn't actually in the movie.
But you know what was in the movie? Prometheus was a bunch of fucking stupid scientists doing really fucking stupid things. True. That's what was wrong with Prometheus.
That's true.
I don't know if it was William Goldman or if it was Hemingway. Someone was saying like you have to have like a complete story. Even if you don't tell the whole story, you need to have like all that stuff in the background that you've built up and then only tell one part of it, even though you may not tell it all, but you know it's there, is kind of an interesting model.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I think that does make a lot of sense. I think the real crime with the director's cut, they replaced the Killing Moon, the Echo and the Bunnymen song, with Never Tear Us Apart by NXS.
Oh, that's funny.
Because I love the opening of the movie and the Killing Moon, and I think it just works beautifully. And Richard Kelly originally wanted Never Tear Us Apart, but they couldn't get the rights to it, and so they switched it out. And I think it works a lot better.
It reminded me of my junior prom.
Yeah, so even Ian McCulloch, who is the lead singer of Echo and the Bunnymen, he branded Kelly a knobhead for making the change.
That's funny. Roger Ebert, he gave it 2.5 stars, and he compared it to Usual Suspects. And he said there was a couple of movies. Mulholland Drive was another one that came out around this time that had a lot of questions that weren't answered. His quote from his review was, "I could tell what I think happens at the end and what the movie is about, but I would not be sure I was right. The movie builds twists on top of turns until the plot revolves one too many times. We're left scratching our heads. We don't demand answers at the end, but we want some kind of closure." He kind of likes all the twists and turns, but he wanted a little more sense to the story, even without all the questions answered. So he thought Usual Suspects did a better job of answering some of those unknowns, or at least feeling like there's a little bit of closure.
He gave the director's cut 3 stars as opposed to the 2.5 for the theatrical. So
oh, interesting.
The director's cut for him was slightly better in his view.
He wanted it spelled out.
I understand that, but I think that's kind of bullshit to compare it to Mulholland Drive, because that movie is almost indecipherable, and I love it. I had to go online and do a lot of research to figure out what was going on, And yet he gave that movie 3.5 stars and he only gave this movie 2.5 stars. And I think it was because it was like a first-time director versus David Lynch.
Yeah.
One other quote that I lifted out of, I think it was his review for the theatrical version. Let it be said that writer-director Richard Kelly's first film engages us so intriguingly that we desire an explanation.
Yeah.
I think that's a good way to sum up this movie. Like, I was very curious when I was watching it, very engaged, and I thought it was very intriguing. Didn't quite understand where it was going, but it hooked me enough that I was paying close attention to the movie. How about that?
Yeah.
This film, when it was released, made a whopping $527,000 in the U.S. box office. It was not a success, and the total global box office was about $2.9 million. The budget for the film was $4.5 million. One of the problems that they ran into was the fact that the release date was soon after 9/11, and a lot of their marketing material focused on the plane and the plane engine and that kind of stuff, and so they just eliminated all that. So they effectively launched it without really any kind of a supporting marketing campaign whatsoever. So it came and went quickly.
It's got this very dark, moody theme, and people were hurting right after 9/11, and not many people were going to the movies. The people who were, they were going to see like lighter fare. It was released at the wrong time.
What did happen is that it blew up on DVD. So it made over $10 million in DVD sales, and then it's made a lot of money since then with the release of the director's cut. It's definitely a film that has performed well after the theatrical release.
Yeah, for sure. And in fact, it went on to be released in the UK, I think in like late 2002. It was a huge hit there.
Top 10 favorite films in Australia. It's number 5 on that list. There's a list somewhere that I'm not sure who created it. One member of the Australian press created it, but it's interesting. Is this really one of the top 10 favorite films in Australia? I find that's kind of hard to believe. So if there's an Australian listener out there that can confirm that for me, please send us a message.
I have no idea.
Two interesting pieces of IMDb trivia. The first one is, at the wrap party for the film, Seth Rogen and Jake Gyllenhaal agreed they had no idea what the movie was about. That was an interesting note. And then the other one is, writer and director Richard Kelly came up with the idea for the future blobs while watching football. John Madden used to use a telestrator where he'd diagram a paused video to show where the players were about to go moments before letting the tape roll. Kelly watched this while high and started to think about what would happen, hypothetically, if someone upstairs was doing the same to humans. So
funny.
The part that I really keyed in on that trivia note was the while high.
That sounds about right.
It explains
perhaps some. It explains a little bit about Donnie Darko in its entirety. I'm not quite sure, but I just enjoyed that.
That's funny. I don't know at what point I realized it was Seth Rogen. I think he spoke at one point, maybe in the classroom.
It's Seth Rogen's first film, and apparently his first line on film is, "I like your boobs."
That was a great line reading too. Total smooth operator. I like your boobs.
Yep.
Fantastic. During the hallway scene in the beginning, you just see like the side of his face. Is that Seth Rogen? It was so weird.
Did you pick him up that early?
Yeah.
I got him right away, but it's a weird Seth Rogen look, honestly. Yeah. It does not look like the Seth Rogen you know
today.
Yeah,
because he had done Freaks and Geeks. That was like his first acting credit. And I think he looked more like that then.
And then getting onto the production of the film, one thing I did think was interesting, I was looking for meaning in the fact that this film was set in the late 80s. There's an argument taking place at the table, and Maggie Gyllenhaal's character says she's going to vote for Dukakis. And apparently it was just that Richard Kelly, as the writer who grew up in the 80s, writing what he knew. I assume that setting it in the 80s had more of a meaning behind it, but as far as I know, that's all I found on it.
It makes a lot of sense to me. They always say, like, write what you know.
Yeah.
If you had written this, Dave, you probably would have done the same thing. I mean, we'd started our senior year in high school when this movie takes place. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I actually thought it didn't work. I was looking for something else because then I'm like, oh, there's time travel. Why is it in 88? Is it in jump to 2000? It kind of confused me a little bit, to be honest.
You were overthinking it.
Yeah, I think that's what ended up being. Came in thinking like, oh, yeah, it's about time travel. And then you're going back in time to 88 to start it. That's more myself than anything else. The setting and the music and all of that was fantastic. All the music in it from 88 was everything I listened to in 88.
I love the soundtrack in this movie.
It's fun.
I had no idea that this music was going to be in here, so I was just delighted every time a new song showed up.
Exact same. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I had every one of these songs on a mixtape at some point in the 80s.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I was not into this music as much as you guys were, but I got to say, I love this soundtrack. It's so amazing. The head over heels scene, which we'll talk about later, that's an amazing scene. And you got like Notorious by Duran Duran. originally they had wanted the Pet Shop Boys, West End Girls, and they had actually shot it right that way.
Yeah, funny.
But the Pet Shop Boys were big timing them. They wanted $100,000 for that right sparkle motion sequence. And so they had to reshoot it to Notorious.
I can't imagine a West End Girls being a good dance song, honestly. It seems like the Notorious change was for the better, ultimately.
I think they said it was funnier with West End Girls because it's these little girls doing it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have seen it.
I do have a big question. Is the movie a comedy?
I had the same question, Marcus. I think you can make a case for it.
I think it might be, especially the dad. It has a very Heathers vibe to it.
Yes. Yes. It's like a black comedy.
It really does seem like it could be.
There are certain things that are just weird, and I found myself laughing, and I was having a good time. To me, it was like a John Hughes meets David Lynch.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that weird funniness in David Lynch movies.
His is more odd than funny.
Well, yes, but oddly funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys found this, but one of the things that was a steady dose of mild comedy to me was just Donnie Darko's reactions to things. Oh, yeah. When he was walking around. I mean, it's the way he was looking and the glazed eyes, like when he's tapping with the knife, even on the invisible force field. His look is very interesting. He doesn't come across as being terrified either. It looks like he's on the verge of laughter in many situations over the course of this movie.
Yeah.
He ends laughing in bed, right?
He does. Yeah, he's laughing in his bed.
It's just those little things. When he went to kiss Gretchen for the first time.
That whole conversation, too.
You want to kiss me?
Well, I'm sorry. I just want
it to be at a time when...
When what?
When it reminds me just...
When it reminds you how beautiful the world can be.
Yeah. And right now there's some fat guy over there staring at us.
Yeah, exactly.
Cut to this dude. This big fat guy in a red sweatsuit watching them.
He's like, got like a cigarette
or something.
Yeah, yeah. Just so funny. It seemed like something almost out of Airplane.
Yeah.
I know a little German. He's sitting right there. He's like one of those moves.
You know who that guy is?
No. Uh-uh.
He is a member of the FAA, and he was left there by the FAA because they were so confused by the situation with this engine that fell out of the sky that they just wanted him around the area to observe what was going on and observe the family. I only found that out because I read a website and apparently that's noted on the DVD commentary. Perfect example of one of those things that unless you actually get that information from an external source, just some weird looking dude in a red tracksuit, yeah, right?
That's funny.
Okay, sure. Sure.
Yeah. The movie overall had actually a relatively interesting or complicated, I guess, production history and was definitely on the verge of not making it to the theaters. Colin, I think you had a little more info on that.
Initially, like I was just really sort of fascinated by how this movie got started because I don't know about you guys, but when Richard Kelly's name came on the screen, written and directed by Richard Kelly, I was like, who the fuck is that? I haven't seen any of his other films and he really hasn't done that many other films. We'll talk about that in a minute. So he actually wrote this right after he graduated from film school at USC. And he actually wrote it in 28 days, which is the same period that film takes place. By the way, they also shot it in 28 days. This weird synchronicity of 28 days.
This means something.
Yeah, considering that the movie takes place over the course of 28 days. Literally, it started off with him thinking about a jet engine falling on a house. He and the producer, Sean McKittrick, fresh out of film school, had like no real experience, and yet decided that they were going to try to get this movie made with Richard Kelly directing. It was a very hot script, though. It was like everyone was reading it all over town, and they all just rolled their eyes when he said that he wanted to direct it. But ultimately, Jason Schwartzman got a hold of it, and he wanted to play the role of Donnie Darko. It was like it lended legitimacy to the project and also to him. And then Drew Barrymore's production company got involved, and they picked it up and they gave it a $4.5 million budget, which is essentially like the bare minimum. And so this is how this first time very young director got it made with real producers, Drew Barrymore and her company and Nancy Javonin and a star, Jason Schwartzman, attached to it. Of course, Jason Schwartzman ended up dropping out. That's sort of it. And then this whole idea of Frank the Bunny everyone was sort of intrigued by this, and he really wanted it to be disturbing and animalistic. The first scene in the film where they actually shot Frank during the filming, the whole crew got really quiet, and it was like really, really tense. And at that point, Kelly knew that he had totally nailed it, and everyone understood what he was going for.
They did nail the costume for sure. That design is creepy.
It really is.
Yeah.
And this is why I think like a lot of the people were intrigued.
Yeah.
That image itself is actually very interesting when you look at the poster, because you're looking at it, you're like, what is this thing? It's actually creating curiosity about the film just through the imagery used in the marketing. I'm curious to know, what was Frank, the actual Frank guy, going for when he was putting that bunny suit together? Okay, I want to do a bunny suit, but I want to put this like weird, scary, metallic face on it. So what was actually Frank, the kid's, intent on the design of the outfit that he was creating?
Just that. I'm going to take the Easter bunny and make him look evil.
An evil Easter bunny?
Yeah.
That's it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Frank, in his early days during middle school, he subscribed to Fangoria magazine. And so he took a lot of inspiration from...
I like him already.
This is really, really intense for Richard Kelly because it's his first time directing a film. He's super young and he's got to stick to this 28-day budget. They just filmed everything in LA for the most part. It's supposed to take place in Virginia.
Yeah.
He's from Virginia. And
it looked like LA.
It looked like LA. Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry, but...
I saw the plates at one point. I'm like, wait, that's not a California plate. That's weird.
Yeah.
For 2001, on a budget of $4.5 million, I think this movie plays pretty big for a $4.5 million movie. Like, I think he got a lot out of his money. It feels very expansive to me.
No, totally.
Yeah, he did a good job with it, for sure. The actors is really impressive. It's a pretty big list. It feels bigger than it is, maybe because of the stars all went on and continued to do good stuff.
I think you can also thank Drew Barrymore for that. Just the fact that she was involved with this and she like really supported it.
Yeah,
they were able to get a lot of these really good actors. Well, except for Maggie Gyllenhaal, who basically had to be convinced to do it.
Help your brother out. Come on.
They were casting the sister and... they said, well, you know, Jake has an older sister and she's primarily works on stage and stuff. And she was like, do you really want me to be in this? I don't know. Like, I read it.
That's funny.
Like, I don't think I'm right for this. And they're like, yes, you're right for it. Yeah. And Richard Kelly was even a little disappointed that he didn't have enough of a bigger role for her because she was so great.
Yeah.
This is really tough for him. And, you know, he basically had to get the crew on his side. And one of the first scenes that they did shoot was the head over heels shot. You know, the high school hallways and all of that. And it's like a 2.5 minute scene set to music. There's no dialogue. And some of the producers thought that it was just going to be this indulgent music video. After they shot it, he made sure to quickly get the dailies done and the editing done on it so that he could show them. And once they saw it, they were just totally bought in.
That's cool.
They just loved it.
That's a captivating shot. Reminds me a little bit of the opening of Dazed and Confused in some respects.
Yeah.
In terms of going through and meeting multiple characters. In this case, you know, you're only having the music as opposed to dialogue, but I think it's the same concept. And just the shot itself and the mechanics of the shot, how it's moving down the hallway, I think it's really well done. It's very interesting to watch.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. It's my favorite scene in the movie.
Director's Corner.
Let's just talk a little bit about Richard Kelly really quick, which, as far as I know, he's made 3 films.
And I've seen one, yeah. And I haven't heard of the other two, so there you go.
I've seen 2 of his 3 films. As a director, he does a really good job of creating this universe that's slightly off, right? So this is all taking place in a different universe, and everything's just a little bit off, a little bit weird, and I think it's difficult to create that type of atmosphere, and I think he does a really good job of it. I'm not even sure exactly how he accomplishes it. It's just a little off in the dialogue, the character actions. But I just think that being able to create that as an atmosphere is actually pretty impressive.
I totally agree. And that's why I mentioned David Lynch, because I kept thinking about Twin Peaks, because what you just described could certainly apply to something like Twin Peaks.
The look of it, too, has that same, I don't know, a fuzziness to all the scenes. And even the outdoor scenes don't look like bright, crisp movie scenes.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's actually, everything feels a little muted.
A bit hazy.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like if it was done in high def, it wouldn't quite work as well.
Yeah, like a MCU movie, crisp and clean, and right. Bright colors. Yeah. This has none of that.
Yeah. I won't go into the actual filming techniques that they use because I don't really understand any of that stuff.
Probably good not to comment on it then.
They were going for a very specific look, and they really wanted to do anamorphic widescreen, and so they actually used special film stock because they couldn't get their hands on the real like lenses or equipment.
Are you sure you aren't going to talk about it?
Yeah, well, I'm just going to say that the cinematographer is a guy named Stephen Poster, and he's a total veteran, and he was like the second unit DP on Close Encounters, and he's done a lot of movies where he was the cinematographer. It was just this amazing choice because it could have been an experienced cinematographer comes in and takes control from this young director who doesn't know what he's doing. And it wasn't like that at all. They had a really great working relationship. He's a lot older. He basically said to Richard Kelly, from this point forward, we're the same age. There's no age difference between us. And I'm here to give you what you need. And they just had this beautiful relationship. I think he was like really, really lucky to get someone who was basically there to really support him.
What I find really interesting is I almost know more about a movie that I have not seen of his, which is Southland Tales, because I was very fascinated by what happened when that thing was rolled out at Cannes, and it's a pretty interesting, like, you can actually, what was that?
It's a can.
Cannes. When that thing was rolled out at Cannes. Sorry, yes, mispronunciation. The Cannes Film Festival. So it's a pretty notorious reception that he received when he brought a film there called Southland Tales, which I think is almost close to 3 hours. It was unfinished at the time. It had a notoriously negative reaction. It was just shit on spectacularly. And I was pretty interested in it. So I was reading the back and forth between Richard Kelly and, you know, what he was saying about, well, here's what I'm going to do. He took that film that he released, or that he brought to what is it? Sorry.
Cannes,
thank you. That he brought to Cannes, and he actually went back and then did some editing after that and then ended up releasing it. And it bombed spectacularly. And a lot of people say it's the weirdest self-indulgent 2.5-3 hour movies, whatever it is you've ever seen. I will say, after watching Donnie Darko, I am now more curious to actually watch Southland Tales. So I might actually go track it down and just to experience it. Because here's the thing, it's like, you know, you may not understand what's going on in Donnie Darko, but it is interesting and captivating. So I'm kind of wondering if that applies to Southland Tales as well.
And that would certainly be an interesting movie to watch.
Apparently, when he made the movie, he also made a companion graphic novel that was supposed to be the prequel to the movie, which I guess if you read that, the movie made a lot of sense. And if not, you just went in and all of a sudden you're like, who the fuck are these characters? What's going on? So it's a little Donnie Darko-ish in this description, I guess. I am curious about it now. So watching Donnie Darko definitely made me think more about the movie in terms of something I want to see. And then he made a third movie that was released commercially in the U.S. called The Box. It was a $30 million budget. I think it made $33 million worldwide. It had James Marsden and Cameron Diaz. I don't know if you guys ever saw it, but it was one of those. It's like, okay, if you open the box and press the button, someone that you don't know is going to die and you get $1 million. It was also made as a Twilight Zone episode a long time ago. I think it's based on like a Richard Matheson story originally.
Right.
That one did not feel like it was a spiritual successor to Donnie Darko. It felt a little bit more like just a commercial project. I don't recall thinking it was a good movie.
On IMDb, they both get in the mid-fives, so that's not really good. It is interesting that that was a disaster, because Donnie Darko was too. When they took it to Sundance, it was like the hottest ticket in town. They had tons of buzz. It was in Entertainment Weekly. They had the screening, and it was sort of very controversial. People were really uncomfortable with the scene of a teenager firing a gun, because this was sort of recently after Columbine. Harvey Weinstein was walking around Sundance wearing a Donnie Darko hat. He hadn't purchased the film or anything like
that. I was thinking you meant the Frank suit.
No. A hat. Baseball cap that said Donnie.
Got it, from the set, right?
And everyone just assumed that Miramax had bought it. The other distributors left the screening. Basically, when they left, they hadn't signed a deal, and that was like a death knell for them. It was going to go direct to video, but Drew Barrymore was in a meeting with the new distributor, New Market, and she said, "Now you guys are going to release this in theaters, right?" And they're like, yeah, of course. So she really stuck up for that film.
Oh, wow.
A producer at New Market, when he had set up a screening for his studio, he made the really great decision of inviting Christopher Nolan to the screening. And he had just done Memento with New Market. After the film, Christopher Nolan went up to the head of the studio. He was like really supportive of the movie. He said really a lot of nice things. And that really helped them to actually get that movie signed with New Market and released.
Kevin Smith had a comparison of Richard Kelly with Christopher Nolan. He said Nolan was lucky enough to get adopted into Warner's system and was given a lot of support. And he thinks Richard Kelly has just much talent, just much ability and creativity. He didn't get that kind of break. He was kind of lamenting that Kelly hasn't had a better career. And this was, I think the quote was from 2016.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting.
Do you think that we have to officially categorize Richard Kelly as a one-hit wonder?
So he comes out with another. He's done the writing. He like wrote Domino, the Tony Scott film, which is fine.
The script might be okay in that movie, but the editing is, oh my God, fucking horrible. I think you're going to have a seizure if you watch that movie.
Oh, come on. It's Tony Scott. Gotta love it.
No, it's where Tony Scott went overboard with the quick cut editing. No, I'm sorry. That's my least favorite Tony Scott movie, probably.
I'm looking forward to watching it now because I found out that he wrote it.
I'm an NBK fan, so the editing doesn't bother me at all.
Oh, dear God. That's true.
Back to the question at the beginning of the podcast. Yeah, Natural Born Killers would have been my answer, but unfortunately we already did that podcast. Except that I would never have seen Huanggao.
Natural Born Killers is now becoming the reference as opposed to Die Hard that we roll off in these pods, I guess. Is that what's happening?
Sure.
No, maybe. We'll see.
Casting call.
So you have Jake Gyllenhaal as Donnie Darko. I actually think Jake Gyllenhaal is captivating in this performance because he's slightly off the entire time you're watching. I love where he's looking at Frank up in the bathroom and he's, you know, tapping with the knife, or when he's seeing Frank on the golf course and he kind of thinks it's funny, but it's weird. And his overall performance, I think, is very interesting, and it makes Donnie a very interesting character.
Yeah, for sure. He plays it really well because there's like almost two characters that he's playing. He's doing Donnie, the teenager, he's got issues, but he's really smart and a bit introverted and shy. And then every time he sees Frank, he gets very smiley, but that smile is a bit maniacal.
It's almost like he's high when he's seeing Frank.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit. Like he's got the Kubrick stare down, definitely, during those scenes with Frank.
Yeah, for sure.
So apparently he did that as a very specific acting choice too. He kept his eyes open for long periods of time when he was in those, you know, semi-dream sequences. And he did it very purposefully to create the look that he gets in the movie.
Yeah. But it's not like Jack Nicholson in The Shining. He's almost a bit giddy. Do you want to go through who they originally had considered? Because they made the best choice. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Vince Vaughn was one that I guess was directly offered the role and then turned it down. I cannot see Vince Vaughn as Donnie Darko. I absolutely just cannot see that.
He was way too old even then. Yeah, no.
It definitely would have been a comedy.
And then you already mentioned Schwartzman, right? I mean, and then he, why did he pull out?
Kind of interesting. They said it was scheduling conflicts, but I'm now understanding that when they say scheduling conflicts, it means that they pulled out for some reason. They think he maybe like got a little scared.
He saw the Frank design?
Maybe. I don't know. It was a good thing because ultimately they got Gyllenhaal. Mark Wahlberg was, I guess, maybe offered it. Typical Mark Wahlberg, he insisted on playing Donnie with a lisp, which would have been really weird. And I'm glad that they said, yeah, no, we're not going to go that way.
Doesn't it feel like Mark Wahlberg is mentioned as an alternate casting on any podcast we do? I swear Mark Wahlberg's name shows up.
Yeah.
I don't quite get the groundswell for Mark Wahlberg back in the day, but whatever.
Could you imagine that? Like, hey, Frank, like, come on, man. Like, what's going to happen in 28 days? So after Schwartzman dropped out, they looked at Patrick Fugit and Lucas Black. And then ultimately, somehow, they got Jake Gyllenhaal in there. And literally, he read for 3 minutes. Yeah. Him, absolutely. They just knew. He just nailed it. And he also doesn't look too old. I mean, he was 19 when they filmed this.
Yeah, it works.
His father would have looked 30.
So you have Maggie Gyllenhaal in there as his sister. And I don't think the Maggie Gyllenhaal, so Elizabeth Darko, she doesn't really have much of a role at all. I mean, she has the boyfriend who is Frank, who you don't even really know at the beginning of the film is the one who's dropping her off from the date, for example.
Right.
The banter at the table is kind of fun, knowing that they're actual siblings. Otherwise, I don't think this is necessarily a needle mover when it comes to the performance.
Yeah, it's fine.
I mean, they have great chemistry together for obvious reasons. I wanted to see a lot more.
I think the problem is the script doesn't give her too much to do.
Right.
So yeah. It's just a very limited role. So exactly. You can't really. I mean, I think Maggie Gyllenhaal is a really good actor. She's playing the role of Donnie's sister. That's what she's there for.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that movie Secretary, I think it's called, with James Spader?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that's an interesting
one. Is it good?
Yeah, it's good. It's a really good performance from her. It's a little bit of an out there movie, but it's worth checking out.
Okay. All right.
Holmes Osborne is Eddie Darko. And I do think this is a fun performance because he's the typical dad. Yeah. and they're kind of leaning into some of the dad stereotypes. When he was on screen, I'm like, I know this guy. Wait, I know him as a dad. And I think he's the dad from That Thing You Do, that movie with Tom Hanks.
Mm.
His son is the drummer in the band. He just plays dads. I mean, he's a character actor, so he's been in tons of stuff. He's a likable presence.
Yeah, he's funny. He's like completely unflappable.
The great moment that the parents have is when he in particular is trying not to bust up because of the fact that his son has been called into the principal's office because he told the woman to shove a book up her ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's a good scene.
I kept thinking he's sort of like a John Hughes dad in like Ferris Bueller or 16 Candles. Yeah. And he's pulling it off really well. He makes it a lot of fun.
That's where it feels like a Heathers. It does feel like that.
This family, they seem like very fun. They will not take anything like too seriously. Maybe to the somewhat of a detriment, considering their son has at least appears to have mental illness, but they seem like a fun family.
Mary McDonnell plays Rose Darko, the mother, Dances with Wolves.
Yep.
So that comes to mind. Where she sticks out of my mind when I see her, she plays the president in the Battlestar Galactica remake. Did you guys ever see that series?
Of course.
No, I thought you were going to do her role as the first lady in Independence Day, the first lady.
That as well. But but she is, I mean, she's fantastic in Battlestar Galactica. I mean, that's a great, great performance. So it's one of my favorite TV characters of all time.
100%. Totally agree. Mary McDonnell is an amazing actress. She's so great in this. I almost want to say like, oh, I want her to be my mom. There's just like a way about her, the way that she talks. She does not suffer fools, but she's so nice about it.
How do you rank her on your movie moms? You had Mary Steenburgen and also Diane Wiest were your other top two movie moms.
That's right. You did have a Diane Wiest thing in The Lost Boys, I believe, didn't you? Oh, no, it wasn't The Lost Boys. What was it in?
Was it Lost Boys?
No, it wasn't The Lost Boys. I forget what it was. I moved on to other moms.
So when Kitty comes to the door and is talking to her about Sparkle Motion, just watching the way that Mary McDonnell is looking at her, you fucking moron. I mean, that's the energy that's coming off of her. So it's so much fun. That scene's quite entertaining.
Kitty Farmer, talking about her briefly. She's Beth Grant is the actress that plays her. She's great. I know her from the Mindy Project. She's Beverly, the receptionist, and she's pretty hilarious in that.
I went through the IMDb because I was trying to find this, but at some point, must have played a character that I really don't care for because when I see her, I have a little bit of that reaction, and I don't know what role that was previously.
Well,
any ideas?
Maybe this is not that role, but she did play the bus passenger Helen from Speed.
That was a positive role, though.
She had to get off the bus. It blew up. I think she fell under the bus. Ugh, poor Helen.
Yeah.
She's just really good at playing self-righteous assholes.
Yeah.
There you go. That's what it is. So Patrick Swayze as Jim Cunningham in just a very, very weird role. Apparently, he wore his own clothes from the 80s. Apparently, he went and got his own wardrobe. He had stuff that was still stocked away someplace.
That's funny.
His wife went and she picked out his clothes from the 80s. Do you want to wear the pink polo shirt and maybe the tan chinos? It was like, wow, you saved his clothes? Yeah.
That's funny.
Those videos that they did, they filmed all of those at his ranch. When they went on set to film the movie, they showed those videos to everyone just to get a glimpse into what they were in for. And everyone thought it was a riot.
That's funny.
Yeah, the Jim Cunningham character is interesting. One of the ways you can interpret it is that it's a false prophet. And I'm not talking about his kiddie porn dungeon because we will get to that at some point. But within this mythology, there is this idea that the god is actually being directive to actions. The Jim Cunningham character is he helping? Is he hindering? I'm not quite sure. It's a bizarre program to bring into a school, so I'm assuming that this is not a public school.
And they actually mentioned it's a private school at some point.
Richard Kelly, again, writing what you know, he said that this is part of the curriculum for a couple of years in his school.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
How funny.
Part of this is that there's this sort of contempt for sanctimonious hypocrites who peddle feel-good nonsense. And that's pretty much it.
How could you anyway hold that against somebody? You peddler of feel-good nonsense.
We all know what we think about guys like Tony Robbins. Imagine if they bring that into your school and make you sit through that for an entire period. Yeah. No, thank you.
Noah Wiley as Professor Molotov, who I just started calling Molotov in my head as I was watching the movie. I think he's actually pretty good here. I do like that when he's talking to Donnie, he's talking to him respectfully, almost as an equal in the conversation.
Like every living thing follows along a set path. And if you could see your path or channel, then you could see into the future, right? Like, that's a form of time travel.
Well, you're contradicting yourself, Donnie. If we were able to see our destinies manifest themselves visually, then we would be given a choice to betray our chosen destinies. And the mere fact that this choice exists would make all preformed destiny come to an end.
Not if you travel within God's channel.
So I think those interactions are actually pretty strong.
Yeah, totally. They sort of set up Noah Wiley's character and Drew Barrymore's character as being the cool teachers who can connect with kids. They're good teachers as well. Whereas Kitty Farmer, I kept reading that she was the gym teacher.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Well, no wonder she's playing videos about fear and love in her classroom. It's just, what was she even doing in there? Was she subbing for the day? It was weird.
It was just weird.
So you have Drew Barrymore as Karen Pomeroy. You're so used to seeing Drew Barrymore playing big comedies or even the Charlie's Angels stuff. This is a little bit more of a subdued role, and I think she's really good here.
Yeah, she's great. I like her a lot.
I think it's funny. It's only 5 years after she was the high school cheerleader killed in Scream. She's now a teacher.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
She's only 5 years older than Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
Even though she's playing his teacher.
She's a young teacher. I do love what she said. Kitty Farmer said,
go back to grad school.
Yeah.
Take that back to grad school.
This is just hilarious.
It almost works if it's 5 years.
Five teacher, is kind of tight.
It's close. They put glasses on her. They aged her up.
Yeah. I think in Scream, she's probably a little bit older than she actually was.
Drew Barrymore is a producer of the film, and that's largely probably why she's in this in a small role. And they only had her for a week, and they had to shoot this right up front with her. So that's like really intimidating. And they literally only had her for a week because it was like right in between these two films that she was doing. I think it was Charlie's Angels and then some whatever she did after that. Yeah, good stuff by her. I love Drew Barrymore. I think she's great.
She's fantastic.
I've always been a big fan.
So you have Catherine Ross as Dr. Thurman. And what's interesting about Catherine Ross to me is she's always Etta from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And then beyond that, she was in a few, I think, kind of bad horror movies like Swarm. And there were a couple movies towards the end of the late 70s, I think. As you know, I grew up a horror movie junkie. That's where I recognize her from.
Dude, who wasn't in a few bad horror movies in the 70s?
I think that's all they were making in the 70s. Oh, that and the French Connection.
How about Jenna Malone? She's really good. I really like Jenna Malone. In fact, Emily and I just rewatched Saved, which was from like 2007, I think.
No, I've never seen that.
It's fun. Definitely recommend it. She was 15, probably why she really exudes that innocence. Jake Gyllenhaal was 19. So they're a little bit concerned about casting for this because I think they were even looking at like 14-year-olds and like, Jake's almost 20. This is not going to be good because they do have a kissing scene. She's on equal footing with him in every scene that they're together.
I don't know that they give her a ton to do. And I do think that some of her character actions are actually dictated by the mythology, which we'll go into in a second.
Yeah, I also find her storyline a bit tough. No, just a little bit rough.
Essentially, like having changed your names because your stepdad is stalking and trying to murder your mother.
Stabbed her like 4 times or something, too.
Yeah.
Five times.
Yeah.
It's a lot going on in that one character.
That's why I really liked that scene when they're walking home from school and she's recounting all of this. You're just wondering, is this a comedy?
Yeah. Like, what the heck? You want to go around with me?
I know. You want to go with me?
Yeah.
Go where? Are we going home?
All right. Anybody else from the cast?
Yeah, just because I saw this at the credits, but at the very end when Frank, spoiler alert, runs over Gretchen, his passenger gets out of the car, he's dressed in a clown suit. It's Fran Kranz from Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, interesting. Going deep.
Going deep.
By the way, we do have a podcast dedicated to Cabin in the Woods, which is kind of fun. So just a recommendation there. All right, Marcus, you ready to hit us with a plot summary? I'm curious to see what you come up with.
A troubled teenager is tormented by a large demonic rabbit named Frank, who instructs him to commit a series of crimes.
That's pretty short. The world's going to come to an end in 28 days? Or...
Yeah, I was going to say, like, getting into the time travel aspect is a little tough to summarize.
I spent several hours reading articles on the internet and jumping into Reddit and going to all these places really to try to unpack this movie and figure out what the overall mythology is. And I think I have it, so I can run through it if you guys would like.
Did it require doing any ecstasy prior to digesting this information?
Thankfully, no. I was able to consume all this information fully sober and did not need to alter my mind to understand it.
All right.
Should I take some ecstasy right now?
This would be a good time for any listeners who are pot smokers, perhaps take a bong hit to really kind of settle into this concept. First of all, time is the fourth dimension.
Well, that's well established. Come on, Dave. Everyone knows that.
Okay. And then every once in a while, time itself can become corrupted. And if time becomes corrupted, a tangent universe will be created. But a tangent universe can only survive for a maximum of a few weeks. And if the tangent universe is not resolved, what happens is a black hole could form and it could destroy the very universe. Okay? For the most part, this Donnie Darko film, the entire film takes place in a tangent universe. So you're not in the prime universe, you are in a tangent universe for almost this entire film.
Almost, right? The beginning, it's not, and then at the end, it's not, right?
Basically, everything from when the engine falls through the roof, at that point, that's a symbol of the tangent universe.
Okay.
So a sign that a tangent universe has occurred is that an artifact may appear. And an artifact is actually a residual element from the prime universe that has come through to the tangent universe. In this case, it is the airplane engine.
Uh-oh.
Artifacts most generally are metal. And apparently, metal and water are the two key elements required for time travel. Okay. Now, if a tangent universe gets created, God appoints someone to be the living receiver. Now, the living receiver, their job is effectively to try and close and shut down the tangent universe. So I'm just going off of, I know this is weird, but going off of what I got. So in this case, Donnie Darko is the living receiver. His job is to try and guide the artifact back to the primary universe, because that will then repair the rift that has been created by this tangent universe being created. The living receiver is blessed with fourth dimensional powers.
Naturally.
That include increased strength, telekinesis, mind control, and it says the ability to conjure fire and water. And by the way, the Rebecca Sparrow, so the grandma death time travel book that she wrote. So that's what's actually in this book, the stuff that Donnie Darko is reading. Although it says that you have the ability to conjure fire and water, I believe that Donnie Darko does that by busting open a water main with an axe and also using a can of gasoline to set a house on fire. So I will note that perhaps I also have fourth dimensional powers, because I can do both those things and conjure fire and water. I'm not sure I see him like just conjuring them out of thin air, but anyways. Now, if you die while you're in the tangent universe, you become what's called the manipulated dead, and you have special powers, including the ability to traverse the entire timeline that the tangent universe is going to be in existence, which is why when Frank is killed in the tangent universe, he has the ability to travel back in time to the beginning of the tangent universe and tell Donnie Darko that the world is going to end, because what Frank's primary role is, he's trying to guide Donnie Darko through this journey. If you are in the tangent universe, you haven't been killed, then you're what's called the manipulated living. And your role is actually to unconsciously guide the living receiver towards his path of actually restoring the artifact and thus saving the tangent universe.
You know what? I've heard about all this stuff before. It's all part of this board game called the Cones of Dunshire.
My simple farmer. You are the architect. So the other thing that the manipulated dead do is they create what's called an insurance trap, which is an event that will force the living receiver to complete the task of sending the artifact.
Insert fast forward sound.
Back to the prime universe.
Is there also an insurance adjuster?
So in this case, the insurance trap that they set is that Gretchen gets killed and Frank gets killed. So the two manipulated dead use their powers to create an event that actually will encourage Donnie Darko to fix the problem. After the tangent universe closes, all those who were in there, which wouldn't it be everybody in the world, but putting that aside for a moment, they remember some of the actions and activities that took place in the tangent universe. So for example, and this is again, not made available in the movie, but offline, apparently Jim Cunningham kills himself 10 days later after this movie, because somehow the fire and him being exposed as a pervert somehow weighed on him and he killed himself.
It's called guilt.
Examples of the manipulated living unconsciously helping Donnie Darko along. So there's the book from Professor about the time travel. So he gives him that. There's the note on the blackboard for cellar door, which of course, when they go to Grandma Death's house at the end, they go through the cellar door. Another example is that the thugs themselves are trying to rob Grandma Death on that night. So they're there and that forces the two, Donnie Darko and Gretchen, out back onto the roadway. And then Donnie Darko had written the letter and that's why Grandma's standing there. Just some examples of the manipulated living. Now, examples of the manipulated dead. So Frank is responsible for providing obviously much more direct guidance. He makes Donnie break the water main so that school will be closed, and that forces Donnie to then meet up with Gretchen, and then Donnie kind of falls for Gretchen after Gretchen has sex with him. That's why Donnie feels passionate about solving the problem. Same thing with the fire. So he encourages Donnie to burn down Cunningham's house because that will prevent Kitty from being able to take the girls on their, what are they called again? Sparkle Motion tour. So that's an example of where Frank is having him do actions that actually influence his own behavior later on. Frank also chooses to go on a beer run when there's a keg and plenty of beer available to put himself out on the road in the Trans Am. Gretchen chooses to have sex with Donnie Darko. You know, he's been so horny and keyed up on that that influences his decision in terms of his revenge at the end when he shoots Frank. And then, of course, the deaths themselves for those two characters are things that weigh heavily on Donnie and actually encourage him to solve the problem. Knowing that that mythology, that's the actual mythology of the movie, because that comes off of Richard Kelly's commentary on the DVD and all these other supporting artifacts, my question to you guys is, how much of that did you get out of this movie?
None.
Zero.
My guess would have been it was all a dream. It was all like flash in his memory as the thing was falling on him. Not even a reality, just like a dream. And then he comes back and this is what really happened. That'd be my overall guess of what happened in the movie.
Here's the one thing that I think is really confusing. Donnie Darko uses telekinesis to rip the engine off of the plane and send it through the portal back to the Prime Universe.
That doesn't make sense.
I didn't get that at all. I mean, at least if he had stuck out his hand or something like that, you could kind of see that he was trying to manipulate it, but just the fact that he's just sitting on the hood of the car. All that in terms of the mythology, I'll say that none of that really translates effectively through the movie in terms of understanding it. But once you understand that, if I was to go back and watch this again, I bet I would find it even more interesting, honestly. And I kind of get why this thing became the cult hit that it did, because there's lots to unpack here, potentially.
I think a lot of that just sound like baloney, to be honest. I can understand, like, okay, you've created a new timeline.
The tangent universe, please use the correct terminology.
Yeah, see, that's just where it starts throwing me off. It's like, okay, you've created an alternate timeline that needs to get resolved, so they're trying to guide you back and get you on the right path.
Right.
That makes a lot more sense than all this living receivers and...
What did you think happened at the end of the movie? Just, I mean, trying to put aside all the gobbledygook I just spit out of my mouth.
My guess, it was a dream. If I had to guess on anything, none of that was actually real, and it was just a dream. There's some weird stuff that doesn't work, because how does he know Frank is drawing that bunny thing? How is that part of his dream or whatever it might have been? I don't know. Colin, what do you think happened?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I really don't. Sure. Okay, we have this whole backstory about tangent universes and the manipulated dead. That explains it. I don't think it's a very good explanation or a particularly interesting explanation. I think it's overwrought. And so I choose to just ignore all of that. When we talked about Looper, none of it makes sense from that sort of time travel perspective, because I don't know what caused the tangent universe. All the stuff that takes place in that tangent universe, and none of that makes sense to me. Yeah. And I don't want to see a movie that adds all of that stuff to it. I really don't.
That would have been terrible.
So when you talk about the camps between the people who are like totally about the theatrical version and those who like the director's cut, I think I'm going to fall on the side of the theatrical version.
Yeah.
Because none of that stuff, when I hear it, I go, no. You know how Lost was so great? When you had no fucking idea what was going on, and it just, you know, there were more questions than answers.
Yeah.
That's why I think this movie really works. And when you start answering the questions, really? That's the answer? That's not good.
It makes it worse. Yeah. I think that moment at the end, Frank's the one that hits Gretchen, and then like he shoots Frank. You're like, oh, it doesn't piece it all together because you still don't know what the hell's going on. It's that moment of revelation of, oh, this is who Frank is. Oh, this is coming together. You don't get the closure of it all. To have all this backstory ends up being way too much to explain it.
At the end, the tragedy of the jet engine, this time killing Donnie, and then everyone else is now still alive. They know something happened, like they woke from these terrible dreams.
Right.
I like that ending to this movie, right? But it's not like a satisfying ending that we had in Looper, where it all ties back together and you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. There is none of that. But that's okay for this movie because I liked it the way it is. And I'm totally fine going, I don't know what was going on there, but I'm okay with it because it was
a fun ride.
The movie is more about all the strangeness and weirdness than it is about the time travel aspect.
I mean, after doing the research, it makes the movie more interesting because you're looking for little subtle things the characters are doing to potentially help somebody along their journey. I think if you sat there and tried to explain all this, I think to your point, I just think people would be like, what the fuck is this?
Or yeah.
Mythology would be too convoluted. Apparently, the first cut of this movie was 2 hours and 45 minutes long.
Oh, man.
So I am curious if you were to see that version of this movie, how much of the time travel stuff is explained more directly. And apparently,
I thought of Noah Weil at that chalkboard drawing out, explaining war morals. And
I think if somebody told me that I was the living receiver, I would be slightly concerned over that title.
I think so.
What am I exactly receiving and who's giving it to me?
Yeah.
So assuming that mythology is real, how does Frank know to guide him out of the bed as the engine is coming down if Frank doesn't effectively get created as an entity until the engine shows up in the Prime Universe? That was one of the things in the beginning that didn't quite track for me.
That's always a problem with time travel. There's one moment that's not going to work.
Chicken and egg, right?
One other take that showed up in some of the reading I was doing is that Donnie Darko is a paranoid schizophrenic, and this is all just a massive hallucination that he's having. However, Richard Kelly says that the pills that he's receiving from his doctor are actually placebos.
But we don't know that because they don't actually say it in the movies. I think that there's a good argument that people who have not seen the director's cut and they are not exposed to all this stuff we've been just talking about, maybe it's not what the director was going for, but I think you could make a case that it's better than what the director was going for.
He's actually open to the interpretation on that as well, based on some of the reading.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I would go for that over anything else because I think it probably explains it a lot more.
That was me. My question, is this all a commentary on mental health, giving kids pills, right? We talked about him giggling and he's a bit manic. He's all over the place, right? Laughing to himself and giggling, and it's kind of awkward and quiet and moody. And so is it a commentary on mental health? Is he a schizophrenic? Is it something along those lines? And that seems more likely to me.
Dovetailing into that, Marcus, I did have a question for you. How did you feel being denied these hungry, hungry hippos?
What?
When he's in therapy and he's like hypnotized, he was playing Hungry, Hungry Hippos. And his therapist is like, how did you feel being denied these Hungry, Hungry Hippos? This is such a great, totally throwaway comedic line. I loved it.
Hey, I played Hungry, Hungry Hippos when I was a kid. Whichever hippo gets the most marbles wins.
I personally was denied playing Hungry, Hungry Hippos.
I don't think we had one.
The other thing is people say that Donnie Darko is a superhero. And this is actually technically a superhero movie. I don't think we need anything else to be bent into more superhero movies. So I'll say a hard no on that one.
Yeah.
I did like when they're walking home,
she asked him that.
Gretchen asks him, you have a weird name.
Like, are you a superhero?
Are you a superhero?
Donnie Darko.
That's one of the things that people point to. They say, well, he doesn't deny it.
It's because he's a paranoid schizophrenic.
He doesn't deny it. Oh my God. Oh, the interwebs.
What do you think Sparkle Nation's prospects are in terms of professional opportunities if they nail the Star Search thing?
Well, I think they first need to figure out their branding because they're called Sparkle Motion, not Sparkle Nation.
Oh, Sparkle Motion, sorry.
they're going national. Dave's got their plan.
I was honestly just shocked that they scored a 3.5 on Star Search after seeing their routine to Notorious.
Then it'll be featured on Dance Moms in reality TV in about 10 years from then.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, true. I did think it was kind of, well, very ironic that Kitty Farmer, who's so self-righteous and moral, and that she's the one who's like so super excited about Sparkle Motion, which is essentially a bunch of very young girls doing sexy dance routines. I just have one question, and this is to either one of you. Are you a survivor of fear?
No, I embrace love.
That whole thing was just hilarious watching that. Are you a survivor of fear? And then that little kid, he's like, I am not afraid. It's just so bad. I think this movie is a comedy. I really do.
There are a lot of comedic elements, and honestly, those videos do a great job of showing you what a creepy version of those videos could be and exist out there, honestly. Those are pretty well done.
Sort of like going to YMCA camp.
Did you have a bad time at YMCA camp? Is that where you completed your DP?
Jesus Christ. No, it was like you go to Y camp and then, a lot of fun. It's just like tons and tons of fun. But then they make you go up, sit around the campfire and sing a lot of Jesus songs, which is like always a little weird, especially when you're going with your two Jewish friends and you're like, are you all right, dude? Did you know what you were getting into?
You guys want to jump into this and just talk about a few key scenes, things we found interesting?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
I think the opening is quite engaging. It really hooks you. The music is great. All of a sudden you see this guy just laying on a road somewhere, his bike's off to the side. You're not quite sure if he crashed or what's happened. And he kind of gets up and he seems amused by the whole thing. What's going on here? You're very interested. At least I was when I was watching it. I'm like, where is this? Like, what's the story here?
Yeah. And he's in his pajamas.
Yeah.
I think the answer to why is he not dead? He's out in the mountains and there's no traffic up there.
If you're laying on the road for an entire night, though, the fact that no cars go by, I mean, that I find that a little bit suspicious.
Yeah, but you're right. It's an intriguing opening and great song, The Killing Moon. Can't believe they tried to change it. Or they did. They did actually change it in the director's cut. People were not happy.
If you were Donnie Darko, though, wouldn't you eventually handcuff yourself to the bed if you kept waking up on golf courses or mountain roadways or these faraway places?
No, that's just sleepwalking.
He didn't seem like he minded it either.
Emily, one of her old roommates, was a sleepwalker. And one night, she walked out of the house. She walked down 4th Avenue and all the way down to Lincoln, like a very busy street. And then she woke up and she had locked herself out.
Oh, man.
Banging on the door.
Oh, geez.
Emily is blissfully asleep, can't hear it all. She ended up having to call her mom.
Oh, man.
It's the middle of the night just to pick her up and stuff. And Emily had like no idea. Could you imagine that?
No, I was a sleepwalker up through college, actually.
Were you really?
Yeah. I used to walk down and get my parents up and tell them things like,
I'm going to kill you.
And my parents would actually escort me back to bed. And then I would do things like, there was a very one really famous one where I had a dream that I was out in the desert and a nuclear missile was coming down behind me and there was the big explosion, the mushroom cloud. And so I got up on my bed and I ran full speed straight into my closet door and I knocked it off the hinges. And I woke up like inside my closet with my clothes on top of me. And then the last time I ever did it, and I think it cured me a bit, I did it one time in college where I walked out of my dorm room. I walked down into the community bathroom and I had my racquetball racket and I was just standing there in my underwear and I came to, and so then I had to walk back to my dorm room only wearing my underwear, which is what I was sleeping in. And that's the last time I ever remember sleepwalking, thankfully.
Wow.
Embarrassment apparently is a good cure for sleepwalking.
I like the dining room table where you get to meet all the Darkos. It feels almost like a...
It's a John Hughes movie, right?
Yeah, like John Hughes. I was going to say Spielberg.
It's half John Hughes, half Spielberg.
Yeah, the family's a little more coarse for a Spielberg movie, maybe. There's like the bickering between the siblings. And
Donnie, you're such a dick.
Whoa, Elizabeth. A little hostile there. Maybe you should be the one in therapy. Then mom and dad can pay someone $200 an hour to listen to all your thoughts, so we don't have to.
Okay. You want to tell mom and dad why you stopped taking your medication?
You're such a fuckass.
What?
Please.
Did you just call me a fuckass?
Elizabeth, that's enough.
You can go suck a fuck.
Oh, please tell me, Elizabeth, how exactly does one suck a fuck?
You want me to tell you?
Please tell me.
We will not have this at the dinner table. Stop.
Fuck.
What's a fuckass?
The end, you have the little daughter saying, what's a fuckass?
She's so much younger. And then what's the dad doing? He's not going, children, your language. He's just looking at little Samantha. Plug your ears.
Yeah, earmuffs. Yeah,
earmuffs.
The mom's getting kind of annoyed by it all. She can't stop it. It's a fun scene. It does set the tone of a lighter mood. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and it's kind of nice too, because the family is, they're giving each other shit, but you get the sense that they would actually be there for each other and be supportive. I mean, it seems like it's an overall nice environment, which is, a nice change from a lot of movies where you end up with some super asshole dad or whatever.
I think probably the first 15 to 20 minutes of this movie, I really love. You could call it the world building. I think it's great. I mean, I was just completely taken in.
It's captivating.
Yeah, it really is.
she gives him shit during the dinner conversation about taking his medication. And so, you know, he goes upstairs to take his medication. And just one thing I noticed, it always sticks out to me, is how people take pills in the movies versus real life. You put a pill in your hand and then you slap yourself in the face really hard so the pill goes way back down your throat. I mean, have you guys ever taken a pill that way? Have you ever put one in your hand and just like jammed it in your mouth that way?
No.
I have not either.
Did he at least drink some water? I don't remember.
I think he might have dry swallowed it, actually.
I forget what movie we were doing, but I made a similar mention. Tough guys always, they just take a bunch of pills and just crunch down on them instead of just swallowing them.
Right. Well, and my other question here was, so there are a couple scenes throughout the movie where he's in the bathroom, and this is one of the places where he sees Frank, the barrier between the two realities, I guess, possibly. Although all this is taking place in the Tangent universe, so where Frank is versus where he is, I'm not quite clear.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Dave. Can you tell me, what is the value of the universal constant in the Tangent universe? I think that would help me to really make that determination.
Colin, I recommend you spend a couple hours going down the Donnie Darko internet rabbit hole, and you will have all your questions answered.
Okay.
But I do like those scenes, because one of the things that's interesting is, you know, where he has the knife, for example, and he's tapping. It's not aggressive. It's almost like he's just sort of probing and checking it out. But the interesting thing there is that Frank's eye starts glowing, and of course, that's the same eye that he gets shot in later in the movie. Mm-hmm. So there are all these little clues or breadcrumbs that they drop where they're foreshadowing things or hinting at things. The slightly warped perspective. Donnie Darko looks half crazy, half asleep. He looks like he's off. And, yeah. But it's an effective, I mean, it's fun to look at, because those scenes, I think, are actually pretty compelling.
Yeah, he also looks kind of half amused by it all, bewildered.
Yeah.
He's definitely amused and somewhat almost... how would you describe it? Kind of like, what the fuck is this? Like, yeah, there's a little bit of that.
Also remind me a bit, and maybe it's just the special effects of The Matrix, when Neo has that interaction with the mirror, kind of similar.
I think they got the team from The Matrix and The Abyss to do the special effects for this movie.
That is exactly, that's what it is, it's The Abyss.
Yeah, raise your hand if you think that was a Russian water tentacle. Next scene, and this is one that Colin referenced, but I do think that the opening shot in the high school is pretty great. The music, the way that the camera slides around, all the character introductions. I just think it's a really, really cool shot. I enjoyed watching it.
It is awesome. I've watched this scene now like 4, 5 or 6 times. When this podcast is over, I'm going to go watch it again. It's that good. I really love it. And I don't know if it's because I just really love that song.
You're a big Tears for Fears fan?
No, I was not a big Tears for Fears fan in high school. But I don't know, the Head Over Heels, just something about that song and this scene. I mean, there's no dialogue. It's choreographed really well. It starts exactly when Donnie jumps from the school bus and lands on his feet, and then the music starts. Camera like spins 90 degrees and you follow them in.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's in sync with the sparkle motion dance routine that they're doing. It's really well done. And then they're doing speed ramping.
Speed ramping, yeah, little elements of speed ramping.
Little moments of speed ramping, but then they're also doing moments of slow-mo. And it's all with a mind of getting this whole scene in the 2 minutes and 33 seconds or whatever that the song plays. And they had to go and time it. Originally, Richard Kelly wanted to do it as one Steadicam shot. And the DP told him, yeah, I tell you what, take the camera operator into the hallway and take a stopwatch and you guys go figure it out. And Richard Kelly came back 20 minutes later and said, okay, we're doing it in 5 shots. He knew it was going to be impossible. But somehow they did this and they made it work. And it's really good. I really love just getting the whole introduction to all these different characters all in this one shot. I mean, you got Donnie and his friends, the bullies, the uptight teacher, the pretty girl, the reject, the principals. And you end up in the classroom. It really got me sucked into this world. I would say that it is kind of like a music video. So I understand why those producers were very suspicious, thinking it was this going to be self-indulgent. I really love it. And maybe it's because it does sort of harken back to real traditional 80s music videos, sort of actually telling story.
Right.
I think it just totally works for me.
Showing each of the characters, or the way that the characters are introduced or at least referenced during that shot, is pretty cool, because it kind of lays the landscape of the entire universe of people that are going to be involved in guiding Donnie Darko through his mission. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, you don't know that at the time, but that's really kind of what you get out of it after the fact. But I just think that the shot itself and the combination of the visuals and the music, it's really compelling. It's just, it's like you said, it's just fun to watch. I would go back and watch that scene again just for fun.
Also, Seth Rogen doing a bump of coke in the hallway. Nice.
To open cocaine usage. And then I also thought that that one bully, they modeled him off of Dylan from 90210. There's a little bit of a Luke Perry 90210 look for that one guy. Every time I saw that guy in the movie, I'm like, that's just Luke Perry from 90210.
A little bit. Yeah, I really do like the sneer. He passes Donnie in the hallway. That's a good shot. Apparently that guy is the lead singer of some band now. I don't know which. I've never heard of it, but he's not really an actor. He's a musician.
He ends up walking Gretchen home. So this is after the flood has happened. How old is he? What year in high school is he? He's a senior, right?
No, I don't think so. I think his sister is a senior, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, maybe so. Because she's waiting to get into Harvard.
Harvard. Yeah. Which she got her notice in October. And an early acceptance, maybe.
So maybe he's a sophomore. He is pretty horny. Yeah. Seems like he has not gotten laid yet. So maybe he's a little bit younger. Maybe he's supposed to be sophomore. Junior.
Yeah.
But he ends up asking Gretchen, you want to go with me?
Yeah, it was very odd.
That's really, really odd terminology. Maybe that was something that was the parlance in Virginia at the time. I guess he was trying to replicate that.
He did say that too. He said, oh, that's what we call it here. The whole thing was just very strange.
It's very awkward.
Yeah, that whole conversation was. Earlier, because she's telling her mom got stabbed. Oh yeah, what's wrong with your stepdad? Oh, he's got emotional problems. He's excited. Oh yeah, me too.
Just so, hey, like, there's a connection. Yeah, he just what strange. Kind of emotional problems? He tried to stab my mom 4 times.
Yeah.
And by the way, the elementary school term for this was not want to go with me. It was
go around. Yeah, go around.
At least it was in the San Jose, California area.
Yeah, it's a regional thing.
That's funny.
My dad used to always say, well, where are you going to go around?
Did you guys ever ask a girl to go around with you?
Probably elementary school.
Yeah, like in fifth grade, I think. Fourth grade, fifth grade. It always lasts 1 week. That's it. It's all time boxed.
Then you push him off your bike?
Whatever time until the weekend, and then you start over on Monday.
You just spend the entire week avoiding each other.
Young love.
Maybe you send a few notes.
Some notes. Yeah, notes are always good. Multiple page notes. Got to have a few of those.
We sort of skipped over the whole engine falling on the house. Going back to the family for a sec. I did want to call out, and this is specifically about Mary McDonnell. This family, I said, they don't take things too seriously. They're standing around. Their house is almost destroyed. All these people around, huge crane. They're pulling a jet engine out of their house. And when they see Donnie, they're sort of like relieved because they thought he might have been killed or something in the house.
Right.
Because he wasn't there. And then her expression is just sort of like, eh, whatever. She's very, it's very whimsical almost.
Yeah.
It's so not what you would expect.
I think they were all dipping into Donnie's medication.
They might have been. That's another reason why I like this movie, because it's just everything's a little bit off, like you said before. It's just a little bit off.
The concept of a jet engine falling into a house is a pretty good one. That's a very interesting concept. What? How'd that happen? It's just plane crash is one thing, but just having the jet engine itself just drop that's kind of wild.
And no other plane and nothing else happened. No explanation.
Apparently the FAA said sometimes parts, but the engine would not fall off. And then like a month later, the engine fell off of a plane and landed on a beach. Really?
Yeah. Whoops. Okay. So we've got to offer a retraction to the crew of Donnie Darko.
I did like the dad. I think they were driving in the car. I hope the airline doesn't stiff us on the shingles.
I know, right? I love the dad so much.
Can you imagine today, though? I mean, litigious, multi-million dollars, blah, blah, blah. So.
I know. They're just like, oh, whatever. We'll go to a hotel.
Yeah.
So I had one observation, which is, so the hypnosis scenes, talking about Frank, etc. But Donnie's also somewhat horny when he's hypnotized, or at least she starts asking him questions, and he talks about his fascination with Christina Applegate.
I love that.
Slightly more direct terms. So what I think is interesting is there's two moments in this movie where she has him hypnotized. The first one, he wakes up on the couch, his pants are unbuttoned, he has his hand down his pants. He comes to, he's kind of surprised. And then a little bit later in the film, he comes to again and he's in her arms. If you put those two things together, what do you think Donnie thinks is happening when he's getting hypnotized? That's my question.
He's like, more hypnotism, please.
I'm wondering if Donnie has any concerns that she's taking advantage of him while he's under hypnosis.
Interesting thought. I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, he might have a little cause for concern.
Just a couple other things that I noticed. So the school bully encounter, so after the water main is damaged and they start trying to figure out who did it, the guy in the bathroom, things escalate quite quickly.
I was actually quite surprised he pulls a knife right to his throat. Oh my God.
I was pretty surprised by that. And then of course, later in the movie, he replicates that same thing with an even larger knife. But then if you go through the mythology, some of the characters that are in the Tangent universe will act more violent than normal, et cetera, et cetera. So there is some justification for it, at least based on the mythology. So I answered my own question on that one. But otherwise, I was going to say, how is this guy still in a private school if he's a bully and he's holding knives to people's throats and they maybe even suspect him of being the guy that broke the water main? I'm not sure that you get a long tenure at a private school with that sort of reputation.
It was the 80s.
His dad's a senator.
I was going to say, maybe his dad built a building on the campus, I guess. That's how those things work. Just a couple things about the movie theater scene that I found interesting.
I knew you'd love it.
Chud was the first choice for the movie.
Oh, funny.
That was going to be the one that they were going to try to show. However, they couldn't get the rights to it. And then Sam Raimi stepped in. God bless Sam Raimi. Love Sam Raimi. And said, you can use The Evil Dead for no charge.
Nice.
It's like, and you can distort it, do whatever you want with it. So he gave permission for them to use Evil Dead.
Chud, the distributors or producers or whoever owns Chud, they were like totally...
By the way, Chud stands for Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers for those that are not familiar with the Chud acronym.
It's a back-to-back Chud reference.
A movie from, was it the 70s or the 80s?
I think it's the early 80s.
It was early 80s, okay. I think.
Still a movie I've never seen. That, I mean, come on, Chud, really?
Yeah, I got to pick this at the end of this podcast.
Oh, God. Totally big timing the Donnie Darko people and giving them the runaround, and it's a lot of red tape. And so, yeah, somebody from Flower Films knew Sam Raimi and asked if he could do him one solid. And he gave it to him. Also gave him like vintage posters that they put up in the theater, the lobby of the theater.
Yeah, I saw the posters.
Which was really awesome. When they were filming this, they filmed it at the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica. So as they're filming it, who comes driving by, just total coincidence?
Please tell me it's Bruce Campbell.
No, it's Sam Raimi.
Oh, nice.
Oh, okay.
That's funny.
Evil Dead and The Last Temptation of Christ? It's like, what the hell? Oh, it's great. That movie.
Great. That's double awesome. Feature. That's funny.
It was a Halloween double feature frightmare. And so Evil Dead I get.
Yeah.
Last Temptation of Christ, never seen it, so I'm a little bit confused. Is that an ironic usage of The Last Temptation of Christ?
No.
I think it had to do with some messaging across the movie. God messaging somehow, but I don't know.
Apparently, Richard Kelly just wanted to show a film from the time that was very controversial. And so because of that, you know, it came out in
India. Yeah.
I thought it tied to God is Awesome and some of the other religious...
Well, yeah, I actually messaging. Put down in my notes when I was watching the movie, I'm like, Last Temptation of Christ, find out what this means. And then, apparently that's what it means. It was just
that's funny.
Like very controversial at the time. So,
no, my thought was about Gretchen. She must have been really tired because she fell asleep before they even got to the cabin. I mean, come on, Gretchen.
I know, right?
If you reflect on the mythology, she was doing a solid with her, you know, manipulated dead, purposefully being asleep, so it gave him the window of time to get out and go torch the house and come back and have a rock solid alibi.
Okay, so that's one explanation, which I think is totally dumb.
Thank you.
My take on it, it's not a criticism of you. You're just recounting what you learned, rolls my eyes.
I didn't take it personally.
What I like about this, Gretchen sitting in between Donnie and Frank, this giant demonic bunny in the theater, and they're like the only ones there essentially. And she's sitting in between them and she's asleep. It just really ups the creep factor in this scene.
Well, it was funny because after I rewatched that scene, oh yeah, I remember why that was the one scene that stuck in my head from this movie. Because it's pretty compelling because you have the darkened theater. It seems like the bunny is moving slowly, almost a little bit robotically, right? There's a little bit of a Michael Myers thing going on there.
Yeah, it's creepy.
And it's just creepy. And
yeah,
the metallic mask on the bunny is pretty effective.
Yeah, she looks dead and then Donnie looks a bit like Jack in The Shining. Some slightly psychotic look.
Yeah, it looks like he's unraveling just a bit.
Yeah, it's a creepy scene. Yeah, it's good.
Speaking of burning down the house, so he does go to Jim Cunningham's house and burns it down. The news reports that they discover a, quote, kiddie porn dungeon at Jim Cunningham's house. So, both of you, what's your definition of what a kiddie porn dungeon is?
I have no idea what that would actually be. Do you think it was a Theo Epstein connection, or it just happened to be something bad?
Whoa, hold Theo Epstein. Oh my God, the Red Sox are going to call.
Who am I thinking of?
You're thinking of, what's his name? Epstein. No, his name suddenly is gone from my head.
Frank?
Yeah, I don't know. So funny, none of us can come up with that fucking guy's name. Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Epstein.
Thank you.
Woohoo! We're all 50.
Was it a connection to that?
QAnon's going to retcon this and claim that Jeffrey Epstein was secretly funding Jim Cunningham's self-help empire.
You assume that one of the messages that they're trying to deliver is that this guy is a hypocrite and can't be trusted, although he puts himself out there as somebody who's pushing all this positive agenda. But then it's interesting that within the mythology that God is really taking some directive actions. So is it a charlatan thing? Is he trying to point out hypocrites and charlatans in religion? I don't know if there's anything more to it than...
I think that's exactly it. Works for me. I mean, I'm not going to go for any of that manipulated living bullshit.
I think it also just wants to take down the annoying guy. Revenge for him. Richard Kelly might be.
I was happy to see Jim Cunningham go down because that guy made me pretty queasy.
Down with the hypocrisy!
Just moving to the end. So a couple things about the party. When Gretchen comes over, and again, this isn't a tangent universe, so everyone is a little bit off. She tells a story. My house is trash. My mom's missing. You want to go upstairs and have some sex? It's kind of like... Now, she is doing her manipulated dad thing, and there's a reason why she wants to get Donnie way on her side, or inside her, depending on how you look at it. I don't know that it makes a lot of sense if your mom is missing and your house is trash that you're going to post up at a high school rager. It just seems like a little bit of a strange decision.
Come on, Dave. Come on. Don't you know anything about vulnerability? She's very vulnerable in this time. It's so easy to get into her pants.
No, but he's not taking advantage of her. She's the one who makes the move.
No, I'm kidding. No. But I do mean that. It's like her own vulnerability. She lets down her own guard and wants to feel the closeness with him. It seems like her own world at home is falling apart.
Because her dad might have showed up and stabbed her mom to death and thrown her in the trunk of a car and now he's driving somewhere.
I do want to know if her mom was married to the little kid from Flaming Dragon, who was all stabby with Tug.
Also, just one thing I noticed at the party, where you have Ronald Reagan at one point, he's jumping on it. They show the trampoline earlier as well. No sides on that trampoline. That's an 80s trampoline.
No extra protection.
No, most of the trampolines you see these days are designed to bounce kids back in when they go shooting off of it versus the good old days when you
break an ankle.
Exactly. You just catch a sideways jump and then all of a sudden you're in the hedge. That was the fun of it. It was a little bit more of an adventure back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day it was awesome. Like, I think everyone's trampoline career lasted for about 25 minutes. And then they injured themselves, and then it was on to the next kids.
Right. And the other thing about those trampolines is they had the nice wire springs on either side, so if you jumped just right, you could send your foot straight down and then maybe scratch it really good.
Oh, God.
So I'll just shout out to Richard Kelly for tracking down an old-school trampoline for this movie.
I did love the fact that the fat guy in the red tracksuit made his second appearance at the party.
Oh, did he?
See, what was he doing there? He's just lurking around.
No, man, he's a lurker.
I didn't see him.
It's hilarious. This movie really is a comedy.
Yeah.
The more we've talked through this, actually, I'm kind of heading that direction. And then my last thing that I noticed in terms of the party, they jump on bikes and head out, which I thought was kind of strange. So maybe that says, okay, either are they not old enough to have driver's licenses? Is that what they're trying to indicate there? Or is it more just an homage to E.T.?
Yeah, but he drove the car, right? When Gretchen was killed, he took the mom's car. Up to the top of that hill or whatever.
Yeah, but I don't think he had a driver's license.
Well, at that point, he has to save the universe, Gretchen's dead, and it's the higher stakes at that moment. And he probably had his learner's permit, so he's good.
Yeah.
At the party, they play a couple of great songs, Level Tear Us Apart by Joy Division, and then I think, which is an all-time great song, Under the Milky Way by The Church. When I think of this movie, I think of that song too, and specifically that party scene. I don't know what it is, because I've only seen the movie twice now, once, 20 years ago. But somehow it really resonated with me. And I don't know why. Maybe it's just that fucking nailed the soundtrack. Really, really well done.
It's good music. No, I agree.
Yeah, the music they were playing at a high school party was the music I would have heard at a high school party.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah, I did like the Mad World finish, dude, also. Like Gary.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Get to the end.
We're at the end.
In terms of the very end, when he drives up and he's sitting on the hood of the car, there's really nothing that indicates that he's influencing, putting aside all the mythology stuff that I rattled off in the beginning. Is there anything in that scene that leads you to believe that he is taking an action? Because it feels more like he's observing what's happening, right, versus dictating it. So that's the one thing I thought was kind of strange.
They went to Grandma Death's house. They're going there, and then the bullies are there, and they're trying to break into her house and steal her money. And I went right back to the story about, you know, Graham Greene's The Regulators that the teacher, Drew Barrymore's character, was teaching the class about right in the beginning. They also alluded to this at the dinner table and how the dad was saying he's got all this money and kids used to go try to break into her house. So now this is like the third time we get there.
Well, they also mentioned Graham Greene for when the schools flooded, right? Wasn't it at the PTA meeting?
Oh, at the PTA meeting, yeah.
Yeah.
They did all this buildup and then nothing happened with that. They didn't confront Roberta Sparrow. They didn't go into her house. I thought there was going to be something there. But instead, they just get jumped by the bullies, and then Gretchen gets run over.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the bullies are there specifically to push them back out onto the roadway.
No. Yeah.
And Roberta is there reading the letter so that she'll be standing in the middle of the road so the Trans Am has to swerve. So it's all about creating conditions to result in Gretchen's death ultimately, which then creates the motivation, the final motivation for Donnie Darko to go save the universe.
By the way, just a shout out to our listener, Mary Lou. I'm starting to understand your take on my take on Prometheus, because I really understand Dave's annoyance with me during that podcast when I'm start talking about all the stuff that didn't take place in in the actual movie. I feel you now.
We flip-flop position. I guess maybe the last question. Why do you think Donnie is laughing when the engine is coming down? What's your take on that scene? Does he know that he's going to die and he feels satisfied because he has fulfilled his destiny, or is he just waking up from a fever dream and like, oh god, that was weird, and then bam, engine hits him? I mean, what do you think? What's your read on that final scene?
Yeah, I'm going with the mental health, and he's like taking happy pills, and it was somewhat of a dream, somewhat in his head. He's just giggling for whatever. I don't think he knows it's coming. It's already connected all up, but I think it's somewhere along the mental health spectrum, and he's just not right.
That makes the most sense to me logically. I'm starting to think now that maybe he thought back to everything he read in The Philosophy of Time Travel and was like, this is so fucking stupid. It just started laughing.
Or it's him absorbing, you know, 28 days, the tangent universe, some element of that, because they say that you remember something, some part of it, and it's just overwhelming him. And it's like, yeah. It's just like, yeah. He's just frying balls at that point, so he's not quite sure what's going on. I don't know.
He became instantly like one with Frank.
I don't know what would make him happy as a character in that moment, I guess. That's what I'm unclear on.
The pills.
Yeah, maybe it was just, oh my God, that's what was going on. I'm not crazy. There was logic behind all of this, maybe. But yeah, the question is whether or not he thought he was going to die as a result of the jet engine.
Look at September before all these events happen in October. He was already seeing his therapist. He's already taking pills. He was already doing all this stuff.
But he wasn't seeing Frank.
Was that all just in his head or not?
Again, I don't know. And I'm not even going to try to explain it.
Marcus is more aligned to this idea that it's a schizophrenia situation as opposed to anything on the time travel side.
To some degree, but that's not a clear explanation either. How does he see Frank? How does this thing fall on his head? I don't know. There's a lot of confusion about it all. Well, it makes it interesting, though, too. It doesn't need a full answer. It's good to talk about.
To Colin's point about Lost, I mean, it's sort of interesting and intriguing, and the ambiguity makes it more interesting, which is why I'm kind of curious to see what they actually have in the director's cut, because, again, me rattling off the mythology in the beginning, I could see that both you guys were starting to tune out, so not totally on board with it. I'm just going off of what's out there. So.
Yeah.
By the way, we didn't mention this earlier, but he does die, and you get the song Mad World. That cover was written by Michael Andrews, who did the score for this movie. And the score, I think, is really good because he sort of weaves this piano-driven score all throughout the movie, along with the soundtrack with the 80s music. And I think it's really, really good. And it just comes to a crescendo with this amazing cover of that song. I've always thought that this is such an amazing song. And I don't even remember the original by Tears for Fears, but it's nothing like this. And he wrote it, and so he got his high school friend, who's a musician, a singer, Gary Jewell, to sing it. So this was a collaboration with him. Wow, did this song went number one in the UK. When you see it in this sort of montage of all these characters are waking up from a bad dream at the end of the movie, not knowing what happened, but knowing that something significant had happened, and you see, mm-hmm. and Frank is still alive. And it's so poignant and melancholy and wonderfully done. And it's such in stark contrast to Head Over Heels and the stuff from the beginning. It really like pulls at you emotionally.
Yeah, it's a great finish, I thought.
And also, I think that the acting at the end with his family in terms of the stunned looks on their faces when the camera is panning across is also very effective in terms of delivering an emotional beat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The mom holding the cigarette, you kind of get the sense that maybe she'd given up smoking before and then somehow, you know, she's back to it because of this moment. Like, there was a little bit of that energy. And then also the connection between Gretchen and the mom, just the brief acknowledgement of each other, wraps into this idea that there's some sort of residual energy that's coming in from the tangent universe that somehow...
Yeah.
They understand that there might be some sort of connection, but it's very tenuous and who knows exactly what it is.
Though I do have a question about that.
At that moment, you have the little bit of comedy. This kind of serious moment, Gretchen kind of waves solemnly, the mom waves back, and the little kid next to him is like, oh, hey, he waves down. Yeah. Like,
I was going
to
say
she's
that
not
too.
Waving to you.
It's funny. You guys have convinced me. I'm like, yeah, this is, if not a comedy, lots of dark comedic elements run through this film for sure.
But I did have a question, though, about that. Had Gretchen and Donnie's mom ever met?
No, I don't think so. She didn't even know who Donnie was.
Right.
Right. She didn't know who Donnie was.
Yeah, she just moved to town.
But of all the places for her to be riding her bike that morning, of course, she rides past Donnie's
house. So maybe it's not an acknowledgement of thinking I somehow... maybe know this person.
Or maybe the manipulated living come back to memories of the...
Oh my God. They caused another rift and there's a new tangential universe. Oh God. Cue up S. Darko.
It's like only this guy is like in a chicken costume and he has a metallic beak or who knows what.
They made a sequel to this in 2009. Yeah. Actually, they made a sequel to it. Some people made a sequel to it.
Richard Kelly likes it a lot too, right?
He does?
No. He had a comment that saying, like, don't ever ask me about that damn movie or something like that.
Yeah, he had no involvement in it. I haven't seen it, but I read just a summary of it. And it sounds basically like Donnie Darko too. It's basically this movie, but with his little sister, Samantha. It's like they go through all the same things. Was not well received.
Didn't even know it existed until this exact moment, so, with all the reading I did. Okay, well, let me ask you this. Colin, what did you learn from this movie?
I learned that feces are baby mice.
Not bad. Marcus, what did you learn?
I learned that Donnie Darko and Dave have the same taste in date night movies. He took Gretchen to go see The Evil Dead.
Oh my God. Dave, are you in the primary universe or the tangent universe in this?
As far as I know, I'm in the primary universe. I mean, if this is a tangent universe and I'm going to wake... Well, it depends, I guess, how old I'd be when I wake up, because maybe we could talk about that as an option. Well, what I learned is that if I ever encounter a 6-foot rabbit with a metallic face, I should probably listen to his guidance and potentially get my affairs in order. Keep reminding myself of that. All right, closing thoughts. Marcus.
I enjoyed the movie. I thought it was quite good. It's interesting. It doesn't answer all the questions it raises, but I think that's okay. The characters are interesting. The mood is weird. Is it comedy? It's not quite a horror movie. I thought I remembered it more as a horror movie, and it's definitely not as scary as I remember it. It's definitely an interesting watch. It's worth reviewing and thinking about and trying to piece together what's going on. The Frank costume, the rabbit costume, is definitely terrifying and creepy, and even the voice of Frank, I don't know if you talked about it, has this like just creepiness to it. Really great mood and a really great feel to it all. Great performances. So my grade will be a B+.
Colin?
I think that as a time travel movie, I'm going to say this movie really sort of fails. But to me, it doesn't matter because it's not really a time travel movie to me. It's just, I think this is just a really interesting, somewhat sci-fi look at suburbia in the 1980s. It's sort of David Lynch light, which I really like. I don't know. There's just something about the mood, like you're saying, the mood and the feel, really good performances. To me, it's not about story. You could almost say that this is just a bunch of scenes strung together and they're all just a little bit off. There's something weird going on, and it's captivating. I don't care what happened at the end. I really don't. To me, I just can't dive deep into this, try to make sense of it. I'll just take it for what it is and say that I really liked it. I think it's got amazing music, and I will probably watch it again sometime, maybe soon. I know I'm going to be watching the Head Over Heels scene again pretty soon because I can't get that song out of my head. It's so great. And so I'm giving it a B+ as well.
It's B pluses across the board. So I'm in the exact same spot you guys are. I think this movie is captivating, interesting, intriguing, whatever adjective you want to use. First of all, let me say I'm super glad I picked this, and I'm super glad we rewatched it, or I, you know, was able to rewatch it, because my take on it now is completely different than whatever sort of dismissive take I had on it when I watched it 20 years ago. And like Colin, I mean, I will go back and watch this movie again probably in a few years just to go check it out. And even understanding the mythology, I will probably watch it a little differently, and that'll make it more interesting. That being said, I don't need the mythology. I don't need all the dedicated receiver or whatever that thing is. I mean, all that is very, very interesting to look at within the context of the character actions. It really is. It actually explains a lot of weird character actions. But I actually don't know that I need it explained.
Yeah.
You know, knowing too much about this might almost be a detriment. I think that this is one of those movies that the atmosphere is what really makes it effective. And I think Jake Gyllenhaal's performance is great to the point where you're not quite sure, is this dude sane? Is he insane? Like, what's going on here? Is he a bad guy, a good guy? It all remains a little bit ambiguous. And I think that ambiguity is what makes this movie very compelling and fun to watch. I do think that the visuals and the combination of the visuals and music are great. I love the soundtrack, music that I listened to when I was in high school. So I think that it works fantastically. And I just think that overall, it's a movie that keeps you interested in what the core question is for a very, very long time. Like, you don't, you know, some movies you can kind of burn out on. It's like, okay, when are we going to get to an answer? When are we going to get to an answer? I was just kind of enjoying the ride. So I just wanted to see where it goes. All that being said, I wouldn't mind if they did, you know, if there was something that explained a little bit about what action Donnie was taking at the very end, just to kind of, even within some general terms, because it has obviously a cult following, so it's well received. But I just think that some people, it might do a disservice to the rest of this movie if somebody is looking for those answers. And so, like to Colin's point, don't necessarily be super focused on a really tight resolution. Enjoy the ride, enjoy the visuals, and enjoy the acting. And really, in particular, enjoy the crazy character design for the Frank Bunny costume, because that thing is freaky looking. And if you walked out your door and that thing was standing in front, like in the night, it's like that would flip you out. So
yeah,
kudos to whoever did the character design on that one, because you crushed it. Overall, I really, really enjoyed it and glad we watched it.
Good pick.
And now we are at the time where Marcus gets to make your pick, and he was hinting around some things earlier today, so I'm kind of curious to see where he landed. Marcus, what movie are we going to watch?
I had a lot of choices I've been debating. I did talk to Andy, and I'm going to decide on, it's a top-rated film. It's IMDb 8.1. It's the number 217th top movie, which I was surprised by, because it is Rush, an F1 movie directed by Ron Howard. I haven't seen it either. I think, Colin, you have seen it, right?
I've seen it twice.
Okay. And I don't think Dave has. So
I have not.
I have a list of like racing movies I want to watch anyways, and this has been on the list. So I want to get to it. I want to watch it. And I'm quite surprised it's so highly rated that I want to check it out and watch it. So Rush 2013.
I've always been curious to watch that movie. I'm not a huge Ron Howard fan. I don't think he's a bad director. I just think he's a journeyman type director.
That was also my, you'll be conflicted because it has Chris Hemsworth playing Nicky Lauder. So you'll be conflicted with Chris Hemsworth and Ron Howard.
It's not like I dislike Ron Howard. I just think that I like some of his movies. I don't recognize a movie as a Ron Howard movie based on some of the stylistic repeated things that he does. That's just the only thing for me.
Chris Hemsworth plays James Hunt, not Nicky Lauda.
Oh, does he? Okay, I didn't know who played who.
And Daniel Brühl from Inglourious Basterds. Okay. He plays Nicky Lauda. It's a good movie. Yeah.
Cool.
So. All right. So it sounds like we'll be back with Rush. This will be our first racing movie. And then Colin will immediately pick Days of Thunder so we can...
That would be interesting.
Actually, that might be a fun rewatch. Okay.
Another great Tony Scott movie.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed our conversation about Donnie Darko. We all enjoyed it. It's certainly a fascinating movie, and we were all very engaged. A lot to like about the visuals and music. And we all kind of agree that you don't need the complicated mythology that I spent 15 minutes rolling out at the beginning of the pod. However, if you want to do some really interesting reading, honestly, just jump on the internet, search Donnie Darko explanations, and then just strap in for lots of information. or maybe if you want to try an experiment, if you've never seen it, read some of that stuff and then watch the movie if you want to, you know, if you need to have a tighter explanation as to what happens. But I think our overall recommendation would be watch the theatrical release. Don't look for everything to be totally closed out and explained, and just have a good time with it. We all did.
Yep.
And with that, this is the Real DMC Podcast, signing off. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
I like your boobs.
I promise one day everything will be better for you.
Well, I'm just going to say that the cinematographer is a guy named Stephen Poster, and he's a total veteran. And he, in fact, he was like the second unit DP on Close Encounters.
Wasn't Andy the second unit in your DP?
Oh, good Lord. That's going in the outro. Just shaking my head.